My name is Rod James, and this is the seventh study in this New Creation Summer School, and its title is Refusing Our Place and Dignity. So I guess essentially it's a fairly negative study, and yet it's a study that takes us in the knowing of ourselves to better meet and know the grace of God. So let's begin in the garden. The poem says that one is nearer to God's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth. But I'm not sure whether the writer was thinking of Genesis 3. Here we see something that is really important to understand, first of all, and that is this: that Satan does not come to us, rather like the fearsome dragon in a children's animated movie. You know, like the dragon, the evil personification with the fire coming out of the mouth and the tail sweeping around, and we sort of see satanic evil. No. Rather, he almost always comes as an angel of light, and always offers to work pro bono. The term pro bono, for free, comes from a larger Latin term, pro bono publico, which means for the public good. Satan always presents to the human community as coming to help for the public good, pro bono. So the serpent did not appear to Eve as someone wanting to steal and create havoc and destroy, but rather as someone who was understanding, helpful, and with some good ideas. Indeed, he may have contrasted himself with Adam, whom he would have perhaps reflected as being brisk and over-busy and preoccupied, or God, who is negative and limiting. Neither of them, he would have suggested, were really understanding and sympathetic towards Eve's more sensitive and intuitive nature. But he was here to help. And what the serpent suggested was a really good idea. You will surely not die. In fact, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. The woman picks up this helpfulness, and she saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise. Responding to the helpfulness, she took of its fruit and gave some to her husband. Friends, the whole point is that it seemed like a good idea at the time. These words, "it seemed like a good idea at the time," that we sometimes say them and laugh, don't we? Sort of, it seemed like a good idea at the time. But they are, in fact, some of the most tragic words in human history. Now, I want to share with you a quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia that I found on the net, and it really set me thinking with something that Phil's going to put up on the board as I read it. It says, "When a free creature chooses what is evil, he does not choose it formally as such, that is, as evil, but only sub specie boni. That is, what his will really embraces is some aspect of goodness, which he truly or falsely believes to be discoverable in the evil act. Moral evil ultimately consists in choosing some fancied good, which is known more or less clearly to be opposed to the supreme good. End of quote. Sub specie boni, some aspect of goodness. I know it's in Latin, but I think it would be worth you learning that phrase and remembering it for the rest of your life, because it says so much about you and I. You see, those who commit the following so often see it not as evil at all, but as sub specie boni, an aspect of goodness. Hence, getting drunk, it's not getting drunk, it's celebrating. Let your hair down, chill out, loosen up. Substance abuse is having some fun, using something to have a pleasant and a helpful experience. Gambling is living on the edge, risk-taking. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Deception. I was just gilding the lily. Just a little white lie. I didn't want to trouble you. Burglary. Well, it was just there for the taking. I mean, just sharing the wealth around. That's good, isn't it? Physical violence. We needed to have it out. Settle the matter. It was for the sake of honour. Domestic violence. I needed to assert my authority, to let them know who's boss. Abortion is about a woman's right to choose. It's just a termination, and a big problem is solved. Adultery is not lust and betrayal. No, it is always something unexpected and beautiful. It just felt so right. Homosexual activity is to stop resisting your natural self and express your true feelings. Gay marriage is all about marriage equality and inclusiveness in our society. Revenge, we needed to teach them a lesson. Well, that's a good thing, isn't it, teaching a lesson. It was a matter of justice and honour. War, well, war is for the brave, for God and king and country. You can see, can't you, that the list is endless, and it all seemed like a good idea at the time. Sub specie boni. You see, friends, every sinner is a spinner. It's part of our sin nature to rationalise our actions and gild our character with euphemisms. I was just being assertive, unfettered, daring, enlightened, competitive, strong, persistent, broad-minded, tolerant. All of these are good characteristics, but when they are used as rationalizations, they conceal deeper, darker, and more damning characteristics. Indeed, the essence of the whole sin process is rationalization. That is, to give a reason why the forbidden is good, desirable, beneficial. So every sinner is at heart a spin doctor and a willing persistent self-deceiver at heart. So we need to pause here in the study and just remind ourselves for posterity that if I am a sinner, then it goes without saying that I am a willing self-deceiver. I can be brutally honest in unmasking the false motives of others. Don't worry about that. I can see their self-deceiving rationalizations for what they really are. Just think about politicians. But I myself am blinded by my relentless inclination to wallpaper over my own transgressions. Rationalization is the wallpaper that we lay over the ugly cracks and crevices in our bold and blatant disobedience to God. We cover our raw transgression with some aspect of goodness. So, thus far we have seen that their fall, as we perceive it, is goodwards. Our fall is towards the good. Now we're going to see that it is also perceived by us as upwards. Goodwards and upwards. Upwards as we reach out for what could never be ours. To be God rather than like God. And to have an elevated view of ourselves. And so in the deception, we believe that we are the better for it. One writer, seeking to get all this out into clarity, expressed it this way. People who think of human beings as their own centres and lawgivers reject the whole idea of our dependence on a superior being. They find this idea entirely distasteful. To them, the proposal that we ought to worship someone who is better than we are, that we ought to study this person's will and then bend our lives to it, that we ought to confess our failures and assign life's blessings to him, to them, the notion that we ought to take this posture towards anybody else at all is humiliatingly undemocratic and an offence to human dignity and pride. We have stepped up. We have come of age. We are masters of our own destiny, and there is no challenge that we cannot rise to and overcome. The Bible, on the other hand, says that God catches the wise in their craftiness. Psalm 81, "So I gave them over to their stubborn hearts to follow their own counsels." And God gives us up in this deception of upwardness to the delicious theme of our own excellence. After all, thanks, Phil, everyone needs a positive self-image. Now, Jeffrey Bingham gave what is to me continuously a helpful expression poetically of this upwardness of his own upfallen ego. Thanks, Phil. In his hymn, "Out of my nothing, I was all. Out of my everything was whole. Full power was mine to be, to do, and I could only upward fall. I thought myself no God to be, since there was naught but only Geoffrey then warms to the theme of his own superiority. I scorn the shiftless schemes of men, their mediocre dreams and plans. The best surpassed. My mind was keen to go beyond their settled lands. I knew myself no god to be, but I could reach the heights of thee. He then says how his upward fall was secured by the building of a tower of fame. Full height I reared my tower of fame. My city wall held me in peace. I thought to be as thee, O God, and let my strivings never cease. And though my arteries never bled, I owned the city of the dead. Geoffrey then confesses that in this state, he really enjoyed enjoying himself. And he really loved loving himself. That city dead was mine. I owned, I resonated it in its power. I loved the thoughts my spirit bred, exulting in creative hours. No end to treasures I could find, nor limits to my brilliant mind. For Geoffrey, his self-elevated focus, his elevated self focused around his brilliant mind. For others, it may be their amazing body, their meteoric career, their marvelous possessions, or their wonderful personality. And so we see that our fall, for us, is goodward and upward. However, refusing to be creatures of the Creator and servants of the King and children of the living God, the reality is that we have lost our dignity, glory, and freedom through our goodwards and upwards fall. Let's for a moment look at that glory and dignity and freedom. There is such profound symmetry and peace and power and fruitfulness in being what and who you really are. A creature of the Creator, carefully and brilliantly created by a wise and loving Father Creator, and blessed for fullness of life in a creation that was very good. A servant of the King, commissioned to fulfill your calling as the King's steward and ambassador, suitably appointed with divine authority and clothed with power from on high. A child of the Father, created in the image of God and covenanted to be part of his family, eternally dwelling in his house and inheriting his character and his kingdom. This indeed is a beautiful situation. True. And it infinitely surpasses any earthly employment package. It's good to have a good package, you know, with super and house and car and bonus and the whole package. It is nothing compared to being who you really are as creature, servant, and child. So it turns out that our fall is not goodwards and upwards, but badwards and downwards. And there is great frustration and stress and guilt in trying to be what you are not. We've used in New Creation the word ontology, which means things as they really are. And there is great symmetry and joy and pleasure in living in your ontology. My mum always recounted how in her family of origin, her brother, Uncle Jack, when he was a little boy, firmly believed that he, unlike others, could fly. And so he climbed up on the garage roof, and in order to demonstrate this, he jumped off. Mum always said that the experience had a great impact on him. And like Uncle Jack, when we forsake the glory and dignity of being what God has created us to be, the outcome, rather than symmetry, peace, and power, and fruitfulness, is frustration and stress and guilt and a wasted life. Damn it. Adam and Eve experienced this pain and dislocation, and their son, Cain, acted it out. Further, we notice, as we understand the outcome, that those who were tempted into freedom were actually lured into slavery. One aspect of sin is to step out to act independently. No one is going to tell me what to do. I am going to do it my way. But the tragic irony of this initiative is that where we think that we decide to act independently, at that very point we're in fact being deceived and manipulated by somebody else. This is, of course, all made clear in the story of Eve and the ancient serpent, the devil. Far from deciding for ourselves, someone else has decided for us. That's what was going on, wasn't it? And is in coercing us to do as they wish. Someone is telling us what to do. And we are not doing it our way, we are doing it their way. The kind and careful commandments of our concerned and covenanting Creator are despised and discarded, and we fall under the domineering dictatorship of a demonic destroyer. It's all there in the story of Pinocchio, who discovered that the very act by which he thought to be free and independent became the means by which he was terribly manipulated, captured, and enslaved. It's becoming clearer, I hope. The consequence of this is that there is a kind of coupling of contradictions in the description of our situation. We cannot think of it in terms of one direction, but there are contradictions. I'll try and help you understand what I mean. Aspiring to move upwards, we in fact fall downwards. And claiming a goodwards improvement, we harvest a much worse outcome. I'm going to list a list of characteristics that are in contradictory pairs. But the contradictory characteristics actually belong together and are in fact in us rarely seen without their counterpart. The first characteristic in each coupling is an aspirational claim and is the appearance of the matter. The second is the dark underside and reality. Like Adam and Eve, we seek autonomy but live in slavery. Like the people who built the Tower of Babel, we claim superiority but always fear inferiority and failure. Like Adam, justifying himself, we boast of self-justification but live with hellish guilt. Like the Pharisees in John 9 and the story of the blind man, we claim clear sight but are oblivious to our blindness. Claiming to be wise, we become fools. Seeking fame, like Herod, we end in disgrace. He was eaten by worms, but I don't recommend it. Proclaiming advancement, we slide into regression. Striving for prosperity, our experience is of poverty. Nailing down security, we live in fear. Longing for peace, we are forced to declare war. Building a kingdom, we implode into destruction. Claiming heaven, we slide towards hell. In all this, as a race, we fulfill what Jesus said, whoever would save his life will lose it. Finally, before we finish this dismal study, let's take a quick look at some of the social effects of us refusing to be what we actually are. And in summary, what happens is that we try to create our own world and build our own future. And in that world and that future, to have untrammeled and unrivaled rule, and to gather a family about us who will follow us and obey us. You can see that this is going to cause some difficulty. Firstly, creating our own world and our own future. Do you remember Simon, the magician in Samaria, who said to the evangelists, "Give me this power also, so that anyone on whom I lay my hands may receive the Holy Spirit." He was building his own world and creating his own future in the midst of the reign of God. Naughty boy. But even the disciples did it. James and John said to Jesus, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." Creating their own world, building their own future. And in that world we are building, it's important that we have absolute and untrammeled rule. So control freaks and dictators arise continually, even from among the ranks of those who have rebelled against control freaks and dictators. And we work to gather a family who will follow us and obey us. Gamaliel understood this principle when he spoke to the council about Theudas, who rose up claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. But he too perished, and all who followed him were scattered. So he was able to say to the council, in the present case, leave these men alone. Because if it's of man, it's confounded in the way that I've sought to clarify. On the other hand, if it's of God, you won't overthrow it. You'll only end up opposing God. You see, in this kind of construct of creating our own world and establishing our own future, and of having untrammeled rule in it, and gathering a following to support us, sadly, our efforts, well-intentioned, are perceived as domination. We say, generously, everything will be all right if you just do as I say. And the reply comes back to us, most ungraciously, like hell, which is actually shorthand for following you and obeying you would be like living in hell. This problem of seeking to build our own world and our own future and having a family that follows us and obeys us, this problem frustrates and devastates the whole human community. True? Repeatedly, we seek good leaders. And repeatedly, we end up with control freaks, dictators, party spirit, and power struggles. As we have been cunningly deceived by Satan, so we cunningly deceive others. As we have been lured into captivity, so we lure others to serve in our kingdom. As we have been oppressively dominated, so we domineeringly oppress others. And the saying then is proved true, that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But it's not true in one sense. The fact is that the corruption preceded the receipt of power. Don't blame the power. There is only one who fulfills this function of true exercise of power, Messiah. And it was prophesied to him by the psalmist, your people, in Psalm 110, your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power. Why? Because on the day that Messiah has 100% power, he is 100% servant of his father and his brothers and sisters. Finally, in all of this, we need to understand that sin is its own anesthetic. All of the above can happen to us, and we do not see it for what it is. Another quote from the book on sin. Self-deception about our sin is a narcotic, a tranquilizing disorientation that suppresses our spiritual central nervous system, so that the music of creation and the still greater music of grace whistle through our skulls, causing no catch of breath and leaving no residue. Moral beauty begins to bore us. And the idea that the human race needs a saviour seems just quaint. So who can save us from ourselves? Well, friends, that's the theme of another study, not mine. But to close this study and to give us a glimpse of the saving revelation of Christ, let's sing the remaining verses of Geoffrey's hymn. Thank you, musicians and singers. I'm going to suggest that you remain seated. And as Geoffrey says, one day I found the weakened God, whose arteries dripped my deadly blood. Maybe you will find him too.